Sir Henry, they know, was not forgotten at the Tower. His guards laid white-hot knives against his flesh. They pulled out his teeth. "So what must I do?" says Sir Henry. "Lucky for me, my dungeon was damp. I drank the water that ran down the wall."
"And for food?"
Jo says. Her voice is low and thrilled. "Ah, now we come to the best part of the tale. One day," Sir Henry says, "when I thought if I did not eat I was likely to die, I perceived that the light of my little window was blocked. Looking up, what should I see but the form of a cat, a black and white London cat.
Now, Puskins," I said to her,
and she mewed, and in doing so, she let fall her burden. And what has she brought me?
"A pigeon,"
shouts Jo. "Mistress, either you have been a prisoner yourself, or heard this tale before." The girls have forgotten that he does not have a cook, a spit, a fire. The young men drop their eyes, flinching from the mental picture of a prisoner tearing apart, with fettered hands, a mass of feathers swarming with bird lice.
"Now, the next news I heard lying on the straw was the ringing of bells and a cry in the streets, 'A Tudor! A Tudor!' Without the cat's gift, I would not have lived to hear it, or hear the key turn in the lock, and King Henry himself cry, 'Wyatt, is that you? Come forth to your reward.'"
Some forgivable exaggeration here. King Henry had not been in that cell, but King Richard had. It was he who oversaw the heating of the knife, and listened, his head tilted slightly, as Henry Wyatt screamed, who sidled away, fastidious, from the odour of burning flesh, and ordered the knife to be reheated and applied again. They say that little Bilney, the night before he was burned, held his fingers in a candle flame and called on Jesus to teach him how to endure the pain. That was not wise, to maim yourself before the event. Wise or not, he thinks of it.
"Now, Sir Henry," Mercy says, "you must tell us the lion tale, because we won't sleep if we don't hear it."
"Well, really, that is my son's tale. He should be here."
"If he were here," Richard says, "the ladies would all be making goggle eyes at him and sighing. Yes, you would, Alice, and they would not care about any lion tale."
When Sir Henry was mended after his imprisonment, he became a powerful man at court, and an admirer sent him a present of a lion cub. "At Allington Castle, I brought her up like my child," he says, "till, as a girl will, she developed a mind of her own. One careless day, and mine the fault, she came out of her cage. Leontina, I called to her, 'Stand till I lead you back.' But then she crouched, quite silent, and sighted me, and her eyes were like fire. It was then I realized," he says, "that I was not her father, for all that I had cherished her. I was her dinner." Alice says, a hand to her mouth,
"Sir Henry, you thought your last hour had come."
"Indeed, I did, and so it had, if it had not been that my son Thomas chanced to step into the courtyard. In a second he saw my peril and called out to her, 'Leontina, here to me,' and she turned her head. In that moment, her glare distracted, I stepped back a pace and another. 'Look at me,' Thomas called. Now that day, he was dressed very brightly, and with long, fluttering sleeves, and a loose gown the wind got inside, and his hair, being fair, you know, which he wore long, he must have looked like a flame, I think, tall and flickering in the sun, and for a moment she stood, puzzling, and I stepped away, back and back.' Leontina turns, she crouches. Leaving the father, she begins to stalk the son. You can see her padding feet and feel the stink of blood on her breath. Meanwhile, he, Henry Wyatt, in a cold lather of fear, backs off, backs away, in the direction of help. In his soft, enchanting voice, in loving murmurs, in the accents of prayer, Tom Wyatt speaks to the lion, asking St. Francis to open her brutish heart to grace. Leontina watches.
She listens. She opens her mouth. She roars. What does she say? Fee-fi-fo-and-fum. I smell the blood of an Englishman.
Tom Wyatt stands still as a statue. Grooms with nets creep across the court. Leontina is within feet of him, but once again she checks, listening. She stands, uncertain, ears twitching. He can see the pink drool from her jaw and smell her musty fur. She crouches back on her haunches. He scents her breath. She is ready to spring. He sees her muscles quiver, her jaw stretch. She leaps, but she spins in the air, an arrow stinging her ribs. She whirls, smashes at the barb, cries out, moans. Another arrow thuds into her dense flank, and as she circles again, whining, the nets drop over her. Sir Henry, striding calmly towards her, places his third arrow in her throat. Even as she dies, she roars. She coughs blood and strikes out. One of the grooms bears her claw mark to this day. Her pelt can be seen on the wall at Allington.
"And you will come and visit me, young ladies," Sir Henry says. "And you can see what a brute she was."
"Tom's prayers were not answered," Richard says, smiling. "St. Francis did nothing about it, so far as I can see."
"Sir Henry," Joe pulls at his sleeve, "you have not said the best part."
"No, I forgot. So then my son Tom walks away, the hero of the hour, and is sick into a bush."
The children release their breath. They all applaud. In its time, the story had reached court, and the king, he was younger then, sweet in disposition, was a little awed by it. When he sees Tom, even now, he will nod and murmur to himself, "Tom Wyatt, he can tame lions." When Sir Henry, who is fond of soft fruit, had eaten some fat brambles with yellow cream, he says, "A word with you, alone," and they withdraw. "If I were in your place," Sir Henry says, "I'd ask him to make you keeper of the jewel house. From that post, when I had it, I found I had an overview of the revenue."
"Ask him how?"
"Get Lady Anne to ask him."
"Perhaps your son could help by asking Anne."
Sir Henry laughs. Or rather, he indicates, with a little ahem, that he knows a joke has been made. By the account of drinkers in Kent alehouses and the backstair servants at court, the musician Mark for one, Anne has done Thomas Wyatt all the favours a man might reasonably ask, even in a brothel.
"I mean to retire from court this year," Sir Henry says. "It's time I wrote my will. May I name you as executor?"
"You do me honour."
"There is no one I'd rather trust with my affairs. You've the steadiest hand I know."
He smiles, puzzled. Nothing in his world seems steady to him.
"I understand you," Wyatt says. "I know our old fellow in scarlet nearly brought you down, but look at you, eating almonds, with all your teeth in your head, and your household around you and your affairs prospering, and men like Norfolk speaking to you civil."
Whereas, he doesn't need to add, a year ago they were wiping their feet on you. Sir Henry breaks up, in his fingers, a cinnamon wafer, and dabs it onto his tongue, a careful, secular Eucharist. It is 40 years more since the Tower, but his smashed-up jaw still stiffens and plagues him with pain.
"Thomas, I have something to ask you. Will you keep an eye on my son? Be a father to him?"
"Tom is what, 28? He may not like another father."
"You cannot do worse than I did. I have much to regret, his marriage chiefly. He was 17, he did not want it. It was I who wanted it, because her father was Baron Cobham, and I wanted to keep my place up among my neighbours in Kent. Tom was always good to look at, a kind boy, and courteous as well.
You'd have thought he would have done for the girl, but I don't know if she was faithful to him a month. So then, of course, he paid her in kind. The place is full of his doxies. Open a closet at Allington, and some wench falls out of it. He roams off abroad. And what comes of that? He ends up a prisoner in Italy. I shall never understand that affair. Since Italy, he's had even less sense. Write you a piece of terza rima, of course, but sit down and work out where his money's gone. He rubs his chin. But there you have it. When all's said, there is no braver boy than my boy. Will you come back now and join the company? You know we take a holiday when you visit us. Sir Henry leaves himself upright. He is a portly man, though he lives on pottage and mashes. Thomas, how did I get old? When they return to the hall, it is to find a play in progress. Ralph is acting the part of Leontina, and the household is roaring him on. It is not that the boys don't believe the lion tale. It is just that they like to put their own words to it. He extends a peremptory hand to Richard, who has been standing on a joint stool, squealing. "You are jealous of Tom Wyatt," he says.
"Ah, don't be out of temper with us, master."
Ralph resumes human form and throws himself onto a bench. "Tell us about Florence. Tell us what else you did, you and Giovannino." "I don't know if I should. You will make a play of it." "Ah, do," they persuade him, and he looks around. Ralph encourages him with a purr. "Are we sure Call Me Risley is not here? Well, when we had a day off, we used to take down buildings."
"Take them down?" Henry Wyatt says. "Did you so?"
"What I mean is, blow them up, but not without the owner's permission, unless we thought they were crumbling and a danger to passers-by. We only charge for explosive materials, not for our expertise."
"Which was considerable, I suppose."
"It's a lot of digging for a few seconds of excitement. But I knew some boys who went into it as a profession. In Florence," he says, "it was just what you might do for your recreation, like fishing. It kept us out of trouble." He hesitates. "Well, no, it didn't, not really." Richard says,
"Did Cormy tell Gardner about your Cupid?"
"What do you think?" "The king had said to him, 'I hear you antiqued a statue.' The king was laughing, but perhaps also making a note. Laughing because the joke's against clerics, against cardinals, and he's in the mood for such a joke. Secretary Gardner had said, 'Statue, statute, not much difference.' One letter is everything in legislating, but my precedents are not faked."
"Stretched," Gardner says.
"Majesty, the Council of Constance granted your ancestor Henry V such control over the church in England as no other Christian king exercised in his realm. The concessions were not applied, not with consistency. Why is that? I don't know. Incompetence? But we have better counsellors now. Better kings, your majesty." Behind Henry's back, Gardner makes a gargoyle face at him. He almost laughs. The legal term closes. Anne says, "Come and eat a poor Advent supper with me. We'll use forks." He goes, but he doesn't like the company. She has made pets of the king's friends, the gentlemen of his privy chamber, Henry Norris, William Brereton, those people, and her brother, of course, Lord Rochford. Anne is brittle in their company, and as ruthless with their compliments as a housewife snapping the necks of larks for the table. If her precise smile fades for a moment, they all lean forward, anxious to know how to please her. A bigger set of fools you would go far to seek. For himself, he can go anywhere. He has been anywhere. Brought up on the table talk of the Frescobaldi family, the Portinari family, and latterly the Cardinal's table among the savants and wits, he is unlikely to find himself at a loss among the pretty people Anne gathers around her. God knows they do their best, the gentlemen, to make him uncomfortable. He imports his own comfort, his calm, his exact and pointed conversation. Norris, who is a witty man, and not young, stultifies himself by keeping such company. And why? Proximity to Anne makes him tremble. It is almost a joke, but a joke that nobody tells. After that first occasion, Norris follows him out, touches his sleeve, and brings him to a standstill face to face.
You don't see it, do you?
Anne? He shakes his head.
So what would be your idea? Some fat frau from your travels?
A woman I could love would be a woman in whom the king has no interest at all.
If that is a piece of advice, tell it to your friend Wyatt's son.
Oh, I think young Wyatt has worked it out. He is a married man. He says to himself, from your deprivations make a verse. Don't we all grow wiser, from pinpricks to the amour proper?
Can you look at me, Norris says, and think I grow wiser?
He hands Norris his handkerchief. Norris mops his face and gives the handkerchief back. He thinks of St. Veronica, swabbing with her veil the features of the suffering Christ. He wonders if, when he gets home, Henry's gentlemanly features will be imprinted on the cloth, and if so, will he hang the result on the wall? Norris turns away with a little laugh.
Weston, young Weston, you know, he is jealous of a boy she brings in to sing for us some night. He is jealous of the man who comes in to mend the fire, or the maid who pulls the stockings off. Every time she looks at you, he keeps count, he says. There, there, do you see? She is looking at that fat butcher. She looked at him 15 times in 2 hours.
It was the cardinal who was the fat butcher.
To Francis, one tradesman's the same as the next.
I quite see that. I give you good night.
Night, Tom, Norris says, batting him on the shoulder, absent, distracted, almost as if they were equals, as if they were friends. His eyes are turned back to Anne, his steps are turned back to his rivals. One tradesman the same as the next, not in the real world. Any man with a steady hand and a cleaver can call himself a butcher. But without the smith, where does he get that cleaver? Without the man who works in metal, where are your hammers, your scythes, your sickles, scissors and planes? Your arms and armour, your arrowheads, your pikes and your guns? Where are your ships at sea and their anchors? Where are your grappling hooks, your nails, latches, hinges, pokers and tongs? Where are your spits, kettles, trivets, your harness rings, buckles and bits? Where are your knives? He remembers the day they heard the Cornish army was coming. He was, what, 12? He was in the forge. He had cleaned the big bellows and he was oiling the leather. Walter came over and looked at it.
"What's corking?"
"Right," he said. This was the kind of conversation he had with Walter.
"It won't do itself."
"I said, right, right, I'm doing it." He looked up. Their neighbour, Owen Maddox, stood in the doorway.
"They're on the march. Word's all down the river. Henry Tudor ready to fight. The Queen, the little ones in the tower."
Walter wiped his mouth.
"How long?"
Maddox says.
"God knows. Those fuckers can fly."
He straightens up. Into his hand has floated a 4-pound hammer with an ash shaft. The next few days they worked till they were ready to drop. Walter undertook body armour for his friends, and he to put an edge on anything that can cut, tear, lacerate rebel flesh. The men of Putney have no sympathy with these heathens. They pay their taxes, why not the Cornish? The women are afraid that the Cornishmen will outrage their honour. "Our priest says they only do to their sisters," he says. "So you'll be all right, I'll bet. But then again, the priest says they have cold, scaly members like the devil, so you might want the novelty." Bet throws something at him. He dodges. It's always the excuse for breakages in that house. I threw it at Thomas. "Well, I don't know what you like," he says. That week, rumours proliferate. The Cornishmen work under the ground, so their faces are black. They are half-blind, and so you can catch them in a net. The king will give you a shilling for each you catch. 2 shillings if it's a big one. Just how big are they? Because they shoot arrows a yard long. Now all household objects are seen in a new light. Skewers, spits, larding needles, anything for defence at close quarters.
The neighbours are paying out to Walter's other business, the brewery, as if they think the Cornishmen mean to drink England dry. Owen Maddock comes in and commissions a hunting knife, handguard, blood gutter, and 12-inch blade. 12-inch, he says. You'll be flaying around and cut your ear off.
You'll not be so pert when the Cornish sees you. They spit children like you and roast them on bonfires.
Can't you just slap them with an oar?
I'll slap your jaw shut, Owen Maddock bellows. You little fucker. You had a bad name before you were born.
He shows Owen Maddock the knife he's made for himself, slung on a cord under his shirt, its stub of blade like a single evil tooth. What do you think?
Christ, Maddock says. Be careful who you leave it in.
He says to his sister Cat, just resting his 4-pound hammer on her windowsill at the Pegasus, why did I have a bad name before I was born? Ask Morgan Williams, she says. He'll tell you. Oh, Tom, Tom, she says. She grabs his head and kisses it. You don't put yourself out there. Let him fight. She hopes the Cornish will kill Walter. She doesn't say so, but he knows it. When I am the man of this family, he says, things will be different, I can tell you. Morgan tells him, blushing, for he's a very proper man, that boys used to follow his mother in the street, shouting,
Look at the old mare in foal!
His sister Bet says, Another thing those Cornish have got, they have got a giant called Bolster, who's in love with St. Agnes, and he follows her around, and the Cornish bear her image on their flags. So he's coming to London after them. Bolster, he sneers. I expect he's that big. Oh, you will see, Bet says. Then you won't be so quick with your answers. The women of the district, Morgan says, clucked around his mother, pretending concern. What will it be when it's born? She's like the side of a house. Then when he came into this world, bawling with clenched fists and wet black curls, Walter and his friends reeled through Putney, singing. They shouted,
Come and get it, girls, and barren wives served here.
They never noted the date. He said to Morgan, I don't mind. I don't have a natal chart. So I don't have a fate. As fate had it, there was no battle in Putney. For the outriders and escapees, the women were ready with bread knives and razors, the men to bludgeon them with shovels and mattocks, to hollow them with adzes and to spike them on butchers' steels. The big fight was at Blackheath instead. Cornish men cut up into little pieces, minced by the Tudor in his military mincing machine, all of them safe, except from Walter. His sister Bet says, You know that giant, Bolster? He hears that St. Agnes is dead. He's cut his arm, and in sorrow his blood has flowed into the sea. It's filled up a cave that can never be filled, which goes into a hole, which goes down beneath the bed of the sea, and into the centre of the earth, and into hell. So he's dead. Oh, good, because I was really worried about Bolster. Dead till next time, his sister says. So, on a date unknown, he was born. At 3 years old, he was collecting kindling for the forge.
See, my little lad, Walter would say, batting him fondly around the head.
His fingers smelled of burning, and his palm was solid and black. In recent years, of course, scholars have tried to give him a fate. Men learned in reading the heavens have tried to work him back from what he is and how he is to when he was born. Jupiter favourably aspected, indicating prosperity, Mercury rising, offering the faculty of quick and persuasive speech. Kratzer says, If Mars is not in Scorpio, I don't know my trade. His mother was 52, and they thought she could neither conceive nor deliver a child. She hid her powers and disguised him under draperies deep inside her for as long as she could contrive. He came out and they said, What is it? In mid-December, James Bainham, a barrister of the Middle Temple, abjures his heresies before the Bishop of London. He has been tortured, the city says, Moore himself questioning him while the handle of the rack is turned, and asking him to name other infected members of the Inns of Court. A few days later, a former monk and a leather seller are burned together. The monk had run in consignments of books through the Norfolk ports, and then, stupidly enough, through St. Catherine's Dock, where the Lord Chancellor was waiting to seize them. The leather seller had possession of Luther's Liberty of a Christian Man, the text copied out in his own hand. These are men he knows, the disgraced and broken Baynham, the monk Bayfield, John Tewkesbury, who God knows was no doctor of theology. That's how the year goes out in a puff of smoke, a pall of human ash hanging over Smithfield. On New Year's Day, he wakes before dawn to see Gregory at the foot of his bed.
"You'd better come. Tom Wyatt's been taken up."
He is out of bed instantly. His first thought is that Moore has struck into the heart of Anne's circle.
"Where is he? They've not taken him to Chelsea."
Gregory sounds mystified. "Why would they take him to Chelsea?"
"The king cannot allow. It comes too near him. Anne has books. She has shown them to him. He himself has read Tyndale. What next? Is Moore going to arrest the king?" He reaches for his shirt.
"It's nothing to do with Moore. It's some fools taken up for making a riot in Westminster. They were in the street, leaping over bonfires and took to smashing windows. You know how it goes."
Gregory's voice is weary.
"Then they go fighting the watch, and they get locked up, and a message comes, will Master Cromwell go down and give the turnkey a New Year present?"
"Christ," he says. He sits down on the bed, suddenly conscious of his nakedness, of feet, shins, thighs, cock, his pelt of body hair, bristling chin, and the sweat that has broken out across his shoulders. He pulls on his shirt. "They'll have to take me as they find me," he says. "And I'll have my breakfast first."
Gregory says with light malice,
"You agreed to be a father to him. This is what being a father means."
He stands up. "Get Richard."
"I'll come."
"Come if you must. But I want Richard in case there's trouble."
There is no trouble, only a bit of haggling. Dawn is breaking when the young gentlemen reel out into the air, haggard, battered, their clothes torn and dirty.
"Francis Weston," he says. "Good morning, sir."
He thinks, "If I'd known you were here, I'd have left you."
"Why are you not at court?"
"I am,"
the boy says, on an outgust of sour breath. "I am at Greenwich. I am not here. Do you understand?"
"By location," he says. "Right."
"Oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus, my Redeemer!"
Thomas Wyatt stands in the bright snowy light, rubbing his head.
"Never again."
"Till next year," Richard says. He turns, to see a last shambling figure fall out into the street. "Francis Bryan," he says. "I should have known this enterprise would not be complete without you, sir." Exposed to the first chill of the new year, Lady Anne's cousin shakes himself like a wet dog.
"By the tits of Holy Agnes, it's freezing."
His doublet is ripped and his shirt collar torn off, and he has only one shoe. He clutches at his hose to keep them up. 5 years ago he lost an eye in the joust. Now he has lost his eye patch, and the livid socket is on view. He looks around, with what ocular equipment remains.
"Cromwell? I don't remember you were with us last night."
"I was in my bed, and would be glad if I were there still."
"Why not go back?"
Risking dangerous slippage, he throws his hands out.
"Which of the city wives is waiting for you? Do you have one for each of the 12 days of Christmas?"
He almost laughs, till Brian adds,
"Don't you sectaries hold your women in common?"
"Wyatt," he turns away, "get him to cover himself, or his parts will be frostbitten. Bad enough to be without an eye."
"Say thank you,"
Thomas Wyatt bellows and thumps his companions.
"Say thank you to Master Cromwell, and pay him back what you owe him. Who else would be up so early on a holiday, and with his purse open? We could have been there till tomorrow."
They do not look like men who have a shilling between them.
"Never mind," he says. "I'll put it on the account."
Chapter 2. Alas, what shall I do for love? Spring, 1532. Time now to consider the compacts that hold the world together. the compact between ruler and ruled, and that between husband and wife. Both these arrangements rest on a sedulous devotion, the one to the interests of the other. The master and husband protect and provide, the wife and servant obey. Above masters, above husbands, God rules all.